After being the victim of relentless trolling by people who objected to a previous book, Irish writer John Boyne has turned the tables on trolls, stalkers and social media as a whole in his new satirical novel, The Echo Chamber. He experienced a huge online backlash following the publication of My Brother's Name is Jessica, which tells the story of a boy struggling to come to terms with his brother coming out as transgender. John says he deactivated his Twitter account as a result of what he claims were abusive comments. John Boyne weaves this experience into the Echo Chamber. Here he's created the privileged Cleverly family, whose life starts to implode after BBC presenter George sends an unfortunate tweet that goes viral. George's children and wife also learn how unforgiving the public can be when you don't follow the prescribed path. John's previous books include The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, a heartbreaking novel set in World War II. But he told me that he really relished this chance to write contemporary satire.
With the best comic novels, there's always like a serious subject underlying it. And what I'm trying to talk about here is how disconnected we have become from the real world and from each other. You know, this is a novel about a family who, in the past, as we see in the book on different moments, have been very loving towards each other, have been very caring, but they have lost track of each other because they are now completely focused on how many followers they have, how many likes. So that when an actual, you know, trauma or catastrophe happens in their lives and something happens to each of the five members of the family in this book, there is nobody there for them because it's just all these kind of fake people online. But I do want people to think about how they treat strangers online. You know, the brutality of the attacks sometimes is breathtaking. And it's not who I think who we are in real life. We would never speak to a stranger, even a stranger who we disagreed with on whatever point. We would never speak to them with such kind of level of disrespect, I think. I've had so many people kind of, you know, just say hateful things about me, even all the way to death threats, and then finishing their tweets with, you know, hashtag be kind. And you think, well, you know, you're the one sort of like wishing me to fall underneath a tram, and then you're telling me to be kind. It's a dangerous, dark world, I think, online, on social media.
And part of that, do you think, is the fact that you can be anonymous? You know, it gives people the courage, it's probably not the right word, but, you know, almost the permission to say what they want because they don't believe there will be any comeback.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is two different types of, I think, social media troll in that way, because the one who is an anonymous one with sort of an anime picture and a fake name and, you know, there's no way of tracking who they are. I mean, that's anybody who does that. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. But the people who use their real names, I do think a lot of the time they are actually trying to get a reaction. And sometimes I think they feel it's like a video game. You know, particularly if somebody in the public eye makes a mistake, does something, says something wrong, and they go at that person, what they're really doing is like, it's like a video game where you're shooting people down. And once you kind of get rid of somebody or cancel them, as they say, you kind of get points for it and you move on to the next one. But these people forget that the people they're attacking are actually real life people with, you know, with family, with friends, with feelings. And any of us, you know, if you follow us around for 24 hours a day, from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed, we're all going to say something stupid or do something stupid. You know, we can't be perfect paragons all the time. But social media seems to expect us to be absolutely 100% virtuous. And I don't think any of us really are.
John, you are a thorough researcher for your book. So when you were looking at this issue of trolling and social media, how did you go about researching it? I mean, Elizabeth, one of your characters here, she trolls her own family. You know, she particularly likes to troll celebrities. So how did you do your research other than having been on the receiving end of this?
Well, most of it was, you know, about being on the receiving end of it. But then I really, you know, I could see the accounts. And there's thousands of them, really, but the types of accounts that are specifically created just to go on the attack. And, you know, and often it is people who particularly want to attack people in the media, I think, whether it's a journalist, a writer, a television presenter or something. I think there's sort of a bitterness there somehow. And there's this feeling of, you know, how do I find my voice in the world? Why does this person seem to have a voice and I don't? So I would look through, you know, the like, you know, thousands of tweets by people and increasingly unhinged ones at times. And you know, see the way that they carry on, the way that the people that they attack. They very rarely will attack just sort of, you know, Joe Bloggs. They'll go for, you know, somebody with some type of public profile. And certainly I found, you know, I spoke to a lot of like female journalist friends, for example. They get it the worst, as you possibly know this. A female journalist with a kind of an op-ed column in a newspaper, they're always going to get it the worst. You know, people will just pile on them with comments about their looks, their weight, whatever. And in a way that like male journalists don't get. And, you know, I've seen how like destructive this can be to people. And even if we all try to sort of like just brush it off our shoulders and say, who cares? It's just some crazy person saying horrible things. If people do this every single day, and if you are on the receiving end of this kind of abuse every day, it does actually get to you. And, you know, it could be a day where you are really having a bad time. And maybe just that one comment is the thing that's going to push you over the edge.
What feedback have you had? I'm so interested in reading through some of the reviews, John. And I've had this book called, yeah, you know, Brave and Controversial and Bound to Offend. And I think my personal favourite was Late Period Mouth Frothing Thomas Sharp. You know, I mean, do you see your novels in that way? And are you getting feedback this time from people who have had similar experiences?
Yeah, I mean, it's been fantastic. Like, the book came out in the UK at the start of August, and I think it's had the best reviews of, you know, all my 20 books. It's just been fantastic. I think a lot of people are sick of this kind of thing, you know, of this kind of online bullying. And we haven't really been writing about it or talking about it because there is a fear of being targeted and being cancelled. And if you've gone through that experience and come out the other side of it, then you're less inclined to worry about it because you know you can survive it. And so my characters in the book are you know, they're pretty much ready to say anything and they'll do anything. And, you know, I tried to make it as funny as possible. You know, when I started, I wanted to put a laugh out loud joke on every page. But the response to it has been really positive. And actually, I expected a lot of online blowback against it. And there had, to my surprise, and maybe to my disappointment, there hasn't been any like serious blowback. Even though like a book like My Brother's Name is Jessica was just, you know, savaged by these people online.
Well, I did wonder about that because you have a good old poke at wokesters and poots, who we'll come back to because I hadn't heard that before. But let's have a look at that.
I made that one up.
Did you?
Yeah.
I like it, though. It works for me. Let's have a look at the family, these key five members of the family. And we start with George. I love the fact that he was the fourth highest paid BBC television presenter, which I thought was delightful. And he fully believes himself to be a national treasure. But what's his story? Because when we first meet him, you know, we kind of like the guy.
He's 60 years old. He's held a position in kind of British media, you know, establishment for, you know, 30 years. He's very well known. He's a chat show host. Everybody seems to know who he is. But he has spent his life being very left wing, very liberal. And he's always worn that liberalism on his sleeve. You know, in the opening page of the book, you know, we see all the sort of the pride marches he goes on, the goats that he sponsors in other countries, all the kind of really liberal things that, you know, a left-winger like me, for example, would aspire to doing. But he trips up because he makes one tweet where he is congratulating a person he knows who is transitioning from male to female. And he tweets sort of saying, good luck on your journey. But rather than using this person's new name, he, as they say, dead names her by using her original name, the male name. And in a moment of trying to be kind, he does this and the world comes in on top of him. And it's this, you know, this experience where somebody is actually trying to do something, you know, nice and supportive and kind. And because they make one mistake, so many people just decide, well, you're the devil. And the reality is, in moments like that, you know, we're all getting used to new language, to trying to find our way around these things. And there does seem to be a tendency on the part of social media that if you say one wrong thing, then you are immediately just castigated for it, that you know, we're not allowed to make mistakes. So he finds that his entire life of liberal credentials are called into question, and he's just called a bigot.
There's a quote from him saying of his accusers, they won't stand for even an iota of disagreement, pleading for kindness while masking their own intolerance and sanctimony. It's McCarthyism hidden beneath the umbrella of wokeness. I mean, that's a pretty strong statement. So I guess in a way I'm surprised, John, that you haven't had more outrage at this. Although, I mean, you do try and paint
George's...
Well,
maybe I will after this interview. Who knows?
No. But, I mean, the way you're painting George is that, I mean, there's a degree of ignorance, I guess, you know what I mean, in terms of behind his meaning. So he doesn't mean to be offensive, but increasingly he digs himself into the hole.
Pomposity. He has a certain pomposity to him, and he refuses to even acknowledge that, you know, he may have done anything wrong. Now, it's for the reader to decide. I personally don't think he's done anything wrong. You know, he's made one mistake on a name. It's not, you know, you don't have to be dragged off to the Hague, you know, to answer charges on it. But, you know, I find that people online will behave like that, and they do mask their own intolerance in sanctimony, and they think they're activists, but they're not activists at all. They're just trolls. You know, activism is going out onto the streets. Activism is, you see, like the Black Lives Matter movement and statues tumbling into water. That's activism. Sitting on your phone and, you know, screaming abuse at a complete stranger and then, you know, putting the phone down and getting back to Netflix. That's not activism.
And one of his biggest online critics, unbeknownst to him, is his daughter, Elizabeth. As I said before, she really gets off on trolling people and on her hashtag. So, I mean, what's her story? What's her motivation?
Well, she wants to be this thing, which I think is the most awful word in the language, which is an influencer. Anytime I hear anybody described as an influencer, you know, I just want to sort of bang my head against the wall. And Elizabeth is 21 years old. She has no interest in work. She has no interest in anything. You know, she just wants to be somebody who, you know, can sit on a yacht with a glass of champagne, post a picture on Instagram and get, you know, 100,000 likes. And that's how she gets her self-esteem, her validation from likes. And if she's not getting them, she's doing something wrong. And her sort of her mode of doing this is really to target as many famous people as she can, because she knows that if she can get into an argument with somebody famous, somebody with a blue tick on their name, then she will achieve more followers. And she never asks herself, to what end? Well, I mean, what does it matter if you have 100,000 followers or 10 followers? You know, just the number is everything to her, the dopamine hit of likes. And, you know, I see it with teenage daughters and sons of friends of mine who are so, I think, bullied by social media in this way, that if they post something online, they are immediately sort of terrified if, you know, the right kid, the wrong kid in class doesn't like it. You know, will other kids not like it? Are you then, have I posted something wrong? Am I now sort of like, you know, in trouble, or am I sort of not cool for posting this? You know, the stress that these kids are under with this is just appalling. And so I created Elizabeth out of that. This person who just, you know, is so obsessed with finding validation through social media. And yes, she trolls her own father. And at one point, using her fake account, she trolls herself and she gets into an argument with herself. And yeah, I think at that moment, that's probably the most absurdist moment in the book.
Yes, I mean, she was disappointed that her leaked sex tape didn't get her more followers. Yeah. It did make me laugh out loud. And she and her partner at Wilkes for Love, and she's at Truth as a Sword. I mean, they consider going to a leper colony because they reckon that that'll get them more followers. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, Wilkes is the ultimate sort of, you know, halo over the head social media warrior who does nothing really in real life to help anybody, but just is constantly looking for what's today's cause. What can I attach myself to make people think that I am a good person? You know, when he's working in a soup kitchen, he's not really interested in, he doesn't serve any of the soup. He just takes pictures with the homeless and posts them online. He just wants people to think he's good, and he wants the applause for the good deeds, but he never actually does any of the good deeds. And in my research, you know, I see a lot of people like that who just honestly spend all day long tweeting, you know, support for this, support for that, support for the other, but they're not really doing anything. They're just sitting on their phone. It's not really helpful. You know, if there's a cause that you feel strongly about, you know, like go volunteer in a shelter, go help, you know, with fostering puppies. But sitting on a phone and talking about it isn't really achieving anything. So Wilkes is that kind of character, and he's kind of based on somebody who, you know, during my experiences, like just stalked me horrendously for a year. This guy who tweeted 1,134 times abuse at me before, you know, I had to get him, you know, had to get the police involved. And, you know, that kind of person who just targets you and believes that you are the devil, they are the saint, even though they know nothing about you, they've never met you, and they just create this cartoon character. And they put that in the real world and they say, this is who this person is. And that's who Wilkes McGuire is.
I'm talking to John Boyne, author of The Echo Chamber. John, let's turn our attention to Beverly, the matriarch, George's wife, Mrs. Cleverly, a celebrated novelist, though not as celebrated as she would like to be.
Beverly Cleverly.
Beverly Cleverly. And Beverly found some fame on Strictly Come Dancing, which again made me laugh. That's a real institution over there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I have to be honest with you. It's actually a show I've never watched, but... it is a real institution. Everybody seems to watch it and love it. I've never really, I quite like those singing competitions, but the dancing competitions I don't really get into. But yeah, she's a novelist, a romantic novelist, but she, she farms her books out to ghostwriters to write her books for her, while all the time thinking that she is the one who is the great creator behind it. And yeah, she does these kind of celebrity things like going on Strictly and, doing the old foxtrot or the Viennese waltz or whatever in front of an audience of millions. And her story in the book is she's having a relationship with this young dancer that she met on Strictly, but he has gone back to the Ukraine, and as ridiculous as it sounds, he's left his tortoise in her charge. And she's working with a new ghostwriter and, you know, trying to make this relationship work. And the ghostwriter was kind of challenging her a little bit on, you know, how predictable and unoriginal these romantic novels that she's writing are.
Look, that relationship between Beverly and the ghostwriter, who you just describe as the ghost, throughout the book is very, very funny. She said, look, she describes what's going to happen. There are any number of misunderstandings and chance encounters, some witty dialogue and obstacles to their love. You can figure out all those minor details, I imagine, but they get past them and in the end they marry. And that's the synopsis and everything else is left to the ghostwriter.
And it's like, go away and write 100,000 words on this, please.
It's bizarre. You know? What's this based on, John?
Oh, it's just, you know, just madness that came into my head, I think. it's not really based on anything. It's more that she, because it is pointed out that her first novels, she did write herself. But once she became famous, she too becomes obsessed with her public image, with her social media accounts. And frankly, she just doesn't have time anymore to write the books. And, you know, all five of these people, the George and Beverly and their three children, their lives have all been changed by their addiction to their phones. I mean, they barely have a thumbprint anymore from scrolling so much. And, you know, Beverly's thing is that actually, you know, she was quite excited about becoming a writer, and she may have developed into a very interesting writer, except she just can't be bothered writing anymore because it takes away from her self-publicizing.
She tickles me too when she's talking about the Booker Prize, if you don't mind me doing another quote. It says, every year as the Booker Prize long list is being announced, I tune in and I never feel any sense of resentment that my name isn't included. Indeed, I say bravo to those young writers whose books are the sensations of the season, but who will never be heard by again once a paperback is published. And I shout hooray at those aging white men who've been writing the same novel over and over for decades and still don't seem to have got it right. So you're having a bit of fun at your own community.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, you've got to poke fun at yourself as well. And I do, you know, a lot of my books do feature writers, and I do tend to, you know, be a little harsh at times on the publishing industry, even though actually I love the publishing industry and I'm very proud to be in it. But I do like taking kind of having little jokes with it and, you know, poking fun at it. And, you know, Beverly is quite good fun to put those lines of dialogue into her mouth.
The heart of the family is Nelson. Very much. And he's endearing. He's desperately trying to fit into these societal norms that he just doesn't get. So talk us through, I mean, I think it's really important to have someone that you can just, your heart goes out to in the midst of a satire when everybody else is behaving so badly.
Yeah, Nelson is the eldest child. He's 23 and he really struggles socially. He does not have his parents or his siblings, massive personalities. He's very shy. He's very introverted. He can't talk to women at all. He's in therapy to help him talk to women. But the only way that he can survive in the world is wearing uniforms of jobs that he doesn't actually do. So he goes out, he can go out dressed as a doctor or a nurse or a fireman or a policeman. And that gives him his sense of self, some sense of authority and validation as well. And of course, if you're going to go out dressed in one of those and it's a comic novel, you're probably going to get yourself into a few scrapes along the way. But he is probably the most sympathetic character in the book and, has a journey of self-revelation, I suppose. But he is the kindest character, I would say.
I mean, he almost puts himself in harm's way, doesn't he? He goes back to the school where he was mercilessly bullied as a child. And lo and behold, the chief bully is also back at the school.
They're both teachers there. I think with him, it's that, he doesn't actually know how to move on with his life. That, once he finished school and, went to university, all he can do is go back to school. That, the idea of even stepping foot outside London seems terrifying to him. That he's just completely in all possible ways closeted and, introverted, and he has to get over that.
Well, Achilles, the youngest son, his Nelson's brother, Elizabeth's brother, is the opposite of that. I mean, he's young and he frequents this very creepy website, helpmehelpyou.com. talk me through Achilles' motivations, because they're entirely different.
Yeah. Achilles is the polar opposite of Nelson, even though the three siblings actually get on very well and they don't, they're actually quite loving towards each other. But Achilles is 17 and he's real extrovert. He's funny. He's beautiful. And he makes money by basically trapping lonely middle-aged men who want to go out on dates with, good looking young boys. He'll go out to the pub with them a few times and then basically blackmail them. So he's been using his phone with this app, to set up this kind of shadow life for himself. And that comes a cropper as the novel goes along. But, his thing isn't the social media. His thing is like this app on his phone, which he can use basically to make himself a lot of money.
You do. I mean, the book really explores that double-edged sword of celebrity, and you've experienced it yourself. Beverly and George have a degree of it. They'd certainly love more of it. When they have received attention, I think it's affected particularly their children. And you have an example there of the children being photographed, say, when they were young. And we do hear about this kind of impact on the children of famous people or even C-list celebrities.
Yeah, I'm always sort of like baffled by, there are celebrities who seem to sort of pimp out their children from the moment that they're born and, are really, really part of the public eye. And then there are celebrities who, like, you don't know anything about their children. They don't use them at all. And, I think that's probably a healthier way to live, because sometimes some of these celebrities with children, the children grow up and they don't seem to do anything except, be photographed at things, be photographed on holidays. And, they might be in their 20s and you think, do you have any engagement with the world? Do you read books? Do you watch movies? Do you, are you interested in sport? Do you do anything really other than just have your picture taken? It seems like a very shallow, depressing life to me. But, one thing in the book is that, there are five moments before each chapter where we see who these people were and who their children were at a different time before the advent of social media and before social media kind of overtook us, where we see how loving they actually were and how what good parents George and Beverly were towards each of these three children. And all five of them have lost this. They've lost this connection that they had with each other because of this. And the novel is really about them finding a way back to sort of basically getting to a place with no Wi-Fi signal and talking to each other.
You must have put a lot of thought into how to integrate the COVID-19 pandemic into this book of now, in 2021. The way you've done this is that the pandemic is over and life in London's back to normal thanks to vaccines. I don't know, was that what you were hoping for while you were writing the novel?
It was actually quite a tricky one because, the book came out in August. So basically, it's around February when you sort of dot the last I and cross the last T and make the very final changes that can be made. So you know, I was thinking, I've got, because it's set contemporaneously, I felt there's got to be some mention of it, because it would just be weird not to have it mentioned. And I sort of worked off the assumption that it would be over by August. You know, here in Ireland and in the UK, it's, you know, for the most part, it is over. We're still wearing masks on public transport. But other than that, it's, things are pretty much back to normal. But in the book, it does feel like maybe it's a bit sort of 3 months hence, where they're not even doing that anymore. But, I, you know, it's a tricky one, I think, for any novelist right now. If you're running a book set now, you don't really want to have to deal with that too much. Because you don't want it to sort of like people, it sort of to age very quickly. So I threw in some mentions, but I didn't want it to really be a running theme through the story.
I love this quote of Elizabeth. It says, because she's alarmed by her boyfriend's Wilkes' poor hygiene, says, "It was at moments like this that she missed the days of social distancing." I actually thought that was quite a gem. You know, that hindsight that one day we may have.
Yes, well, because poor old Wilkes, he doesn't wash at all because of all the terrible things that go into our cleaning products. So he considers himself self-cleaning, which, you know, may not be the best sort of friend to have in your life.
And I mean, the other thing, John, also, you know, do people turn to art at the moment to escape the pandemic, or are they turning to the art to maybe understand it in a different way to the news headlines? You know what I mean? I think our comedians and our writers are having that dilemma at the moment, is how they do approach the pandemic.
I think during lockdown, like books were one of the things that got a lot of people through. And I know a lot of people have said that they turned back to reading. Maybe they hadn't been reading so much in recent years. But, you know, when you're stuck at home and, you know, your normal day-to-day life is completely disrupted, people do need some sort of escapism, I think. And, you know, books are still a relatively inexpensive form of entertainment and of education. From what I understand from publishers, you know, like ebook sales particularly were really, really soared through most of lockdown, which you know, it was great for writers. And I mean, one helpful thing about being a writer was that, you know, I could still work from home. I didn't face as many difficulties as others would. I could still work. And I wrote most of this in my back garden during lockdown. And it kind of kept my mind off the fact that I wasn't able to kind of go out and see my friends and see my family and live the life that I normally live, or like, you know, that all of us normally live.
John Boyne talking about his latest novel, The Echo Chamber. It's published by Penguin Random House.